Radio City, John Grayson, Rob Ross with you. And thank you so much for joining us on the podcast this week. And boy, do we have a lot to go over. Rob Ross, how is everything going in the music world?
In the music world, it's always shit. But only since our generation started to either fade away or get older and less interested.
Yeah.
In the world in general, it's also shit. But hey, in my groovy little corner, everything's all right.
Good man. That's good to know. And you're right. I mean, everything in the music world has gone down. And as a matter of fact, one of your colleagues on Pop Dos, Ted Ezregadu, will take us through that. We'll talk about that column in just a little while. But before we do, let's start with some of the bright spots, because there are some. And a young man by the name of Hamish Anderson, this guy, I love anything that's got that real heavy-duty nod to the blues. And the fact that he has an almost early Elvis-style vocal that he pops over top of this stuff. Talk a little bit about who he is and where he came from.
He's actually a transplantee from Australia. And he has now unleashed his debut album. And like you, I mean, references aside, just listening to that record, it just floored me.
Yeah.
In a way that I haven't really been impressed or bowled over for a while, to be honest with you. The album is called Trouble, and, you know, for a guy this young, boy, he sounds a lot older than the music gives you to believe. I mean,
right.
I think, if I'm not mistaken, he was considered by Gary Clark Jr., of all people, who to me is one of the leading lights in the blues rock guitar world right now. He was considered to be the young act to look for under 30.
Ooh, now baby's got a hold on me. Ooh, now you really should have told me. I don't know how to win now, baby. I don't know if I can fight no more. Been losing sleep so much, I don't even know what I'm doing anymore. I feel it's got a hold on me. The feeling's got a hold on me. I feel it's got a hold on me.
Yeah. So that's the kind of positive warning shot, if I can call it that.
Yeah.
That tells you, yeah, sit up and pay attention to this guy.
Right, and you look at the pictures of him, he could easily be 18. I think he's got a couple more years than that. And the fact is, you're right, it's not even just the vocals, it's the guitar playing that he's responsible for. I mean, the way he slings that Telecaster around, it's great, and it's on point. And it's hard to think that somebody still has something new to say in that blues rock vein with a guitar, because there's so many quality guys that have trod that path before, and yet he finds some ways to do some new stuff and really impress with it.
But the other thing is also the lyrics. You know,
yep.
Unfortunately, we have become, and I'm referring to our generation specifically, and probably the generation right before us, we've become so ingrained with the older blues tracks that always had the same kind of lyricism to them. The, I love you, baby, I miss you, baby, come back, baby, or, you know, my life is in ruins kinds of songs. You know, genuine songs of misery, if
right.
you will.
Yep.
But these are, I mean, the conveying of the heartbreak in some of these lyrics, it's stunning. I mean, there's this one song that really stood out to me called Never See You Again, how very aptly titled.
Mm-hmm.
And the lyrics say something along the lines of, I feel myself drifting 1,000 miles away, and now I know things, they won't be the same. And now I'm just hoping I never see you again. That's, you know, that's kind of, that's a bite
yeah.
right there.
Right.
But the thing is also, he doesn't stick with one particular style in that blues vein. He goes into soulful terrain, which it broadens it more, because if you stick to that typical John Lee Hooker, Albert King kind of, by way of God help me, Eric Clapton kind of thing, it gets old very quickly.
Right.
I think what I want to say is that this is a very Americanized album, and I think he took a lot of cues from all the right elements. I mean, look, he recorded it down in Valdosta, Georgia, you know, and it's got a very not just American and Southern feel to it. It's got that appealing, here it comes, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers kind of vibe about it, too.
Yeah, right. Well, and that's the same area. Valdosta is just north of the Florida state line. And so you've got Petty, who hails, of course, from Gainesville. And you've got that entire Jacksonville scene. So that area is pretty well soaked with that kind of music. And it was a good place to do it. So Hamish Anderson's Trouble reviewed on the page at popdose.com. You get a little video and some music there for you to check out as well. But yeah, when Gary Clark Jr. tells you he's one to watch, he wasn't kidding. So do that thing. We've also got music out from Derek Anderson. And Derek Anderson, this is surprising to me because not being all that familiar with what he had done before, knew he was a talented bassist, but the style of music is not anything like I would have expected from him. So talk a little bit about what he's been working on.
Well, he's working on, or has been working on, his first solo album. And, you know, you got to love a guy who's going to come out and say something like, most people would be surprised to find that it's by a 53-year-old black guy from Toledo, Ohio.
Right.
I mean, that's great. That is absolutely, you want to talk about putting the kibosh on any kind of over-analysis.
Right.
That's fantastic. And a quick tip of the hat right there. But the thing is that there's 13 songs on this record. You know, there are 12 originals and then a cover of Norwegian Wood, which sounds nothing like it. Except for, you know, you can hear the riff, but it's not in that sitar style that we've all, you know, grown to know and love and have as part of us.
Right.
You know, I love the fact that he deconstructed the song and did it in a way that you know, if you're going to do a cover song, let me just put it this way. I mean, you and I have had this conversation ad infinitum on our own, but if you're going to do a cover song, you do one of two things. You either do it so perfect, it's going to make people cry because it's that good, or you completely deconstruct it and make it unrecognizable so that way it becomes your own.
Yes.
From a Beatles cover, let's talk about this record, which has that delightful, delicious, crunchy power pop sound that you and I always sink our teeth into. And you know, this is one of those records. Now, if I dare say, you know, the first thing that struck me was the Smithereens kind of rock and pop vibe.
Yes,
well, it's because
that's
Smithereens
exactly
are
right.
With him on the track.
Oh, okay, that makes sense.
But that's a big plus right there. You know. Also is the fact that, you know, he's played with the likes of the Bangles, who are absolute masters of the whole Paisley Underground Garage revival. So, you know, he's got the credibility, he's got the pedigree, he's got the chops, he's got the know-how. And God knows, you know, there's just so much goodness on this record.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's the kind of album that you should hear in a just world, coming out of car radios. Perfect example. Send Me Down a Sign is the perfect melding of Teenage Fan Club / Matthew Sweet. You know exactly what I mean the moment I say it.
Right. Well, and there's a couple of things to note about this. Is it sounds fresh and it sounds very clean without sounding overproduced. And that, I wonder how much of that goes back to the fact that you and I have talked a lot in the past about Omnivore Records and the fact that here's a label that has been really at the forefront of a lot of this kind of music, the surprising sort of things that are coming out now. Because when you talk about 2017 pop music, there's a few things that come to mind, and none of them are particularly good words. So, you know, there's a lot of schlock that's out there. And yet, Omnivore seems to be able to cut through a lot of that and to find the diamonds in the rough, and this is definitely one of them.
Well, I here's the thing about Omnivore to me, is that first and foremost, they are I consider them not a reissues label, but a legacy label.
Yes.
Because what they're doing is they're excavating things that have been left in the dust for far too long and breathing new life into them, cleaning them up and reshining the gems that they've discovered. Signing newer artists like Derek Anderson, I think, is a nod in the right direction of splitting the seams. You know, on the one side, you have the resurrection music. The other side, you have – the artists who continue in that style but are, in fact, previously untapped sources of talent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And Omnivore have music people. That's the key thing about them, which
right.
is what I love about them so much. You know, like Sundazed, like most of the folks at Rhino, they have a love of music, and that's why they still do it. This is not just some kind of quick cash grab. You know, they take the time to nurse the projects, whether it's the music, you know, on the discs or the physical product itself. When you look at the packaging, there's a lot, they're always labors of love.
Yeah.
And that's what I think is so important about a label and a group like the people at Omnivore. They take the time and care because it's the essence of what they're doing. This isn't just for the sake of raking in the bucks, because I'm pretty sure that with the cachet that they've already gotten, one of the majors would just love to put, you know, all their money into it and probably try and buy them out.
And ruin them.
So, yeah, and gut them and do what they do with all the other,
mm-hmm.
you know, revival and legacy labels out there. But no, I think Omnivore really does have the finger on the pulse of how to go about doing things. And also, to me, they don't seem to sign young acts. I mean, Derek Anderson is my age. So, you know, it's a case of they'll sign older, seasoned acts who haven't been heard before, and much, much, much to their credit.
Yeah. So
thanks for doing so.
Right. Well done to Omnivore, and well done to Derek Anderson on this album. It's called A World of My Own, and again, it's nothing like you would expect, but everything like you would want. So again, go check it out. There's video and music there for you on the page. Rob Ross, John Grayson here with you, doing a little talk on Radio City this week, and we've also got a premiere video, a world premiere from Pop Dos this week, from Hunter Sharp. Who is Hunter Sharp?
He's a young guitarist from Austin, Texas, and I gotta tell you, you know, I'm not usually gaga on hearing somebody through a video. I want to hear the album.
Yep.
But, you know, I gave this a listen, and damn, he's raw. He's got it. He brings it. And he's a young guy. He's 20 years old, you know?
Yeah.
And he's got this really kick-ass band. In fact, one of them happens to be the son of, do you remember Charlie Sexton?
Yeah, oh,
he's
sure.
So Lonely? Yeah. His son is in this band, and they play, like, hundreds of dates, so they are a really well-oiled live machine, and they did a ton of gigs at the recent South by Southwest. I think it was something like 10 or so shows during the festival, which has to be some kind of record.
Mm-hmm.
And they've just put out this first EP called Forced Landings, and this track, it just has motor to it.
Hey, Kim Jong-un.
And now I want to see what comes next. I don't want to see. I want to hear what comes next.
Definitely. But, you know, let me talk a little bit about the video for this, because there are some echoes there as well. And like you said, I mean, this is a guy who clearly at a young age, you know, these young kids with their guitars, Rob, I don't know what's going on here. They're making good music. So while all of that's going on, there's something else about this, is that the way that this video was shot and the feel of it is very much a throwback to when I was in 1983, 1984, 1985, watching MTV and getting a lot of my music that way. In fact, you know what it feels? It reminded me of, even though the cars obviously are a little bit newer than that, it reminded me of the Hollywood Boulevard montage in Valley Girl. And it just had that same kind of glowy, almost dreamlike quality to it. And it's another driving video. It works. And it's not overdone. There's not so much going on that it distracts from the music.
Right. And the other thing about the video is the fact that it's got that old-fashioned video. You can believe we were actually using a phrase like old-fashioned video. Is that an oxymoron?
Yeah, right.
For something like videos. But it's got the cinematic quality from that period.
Yep.
When videos were made to be small films.
Right.
With a story to them.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, tip of the hat to whoever shot this, because it delivers the new artist to you while giving you a little bit of a story to it.
Yeah, yeah, which is exactly what it should be, a little bit of story to add to the video. So, again, more good news and more good music online at popdose.com. Rob Ross and John Grayson here with you, talking a little bit about what else is on the site. And what else is on the site, and I love this, D.W. Dunphy got to sit down with one of the main names behind a film company called Troma. Now, Troma is one of those things where either you know them or you don't, and if you know them, you love them, because this is the production company that gave us Toxic Avenger. Orgasmo was one of theirs. I mean, they're all these absolutely bizarre movies, and they have a look to them. I mean, there's certainly a signature movie making kind of I guess. Boy, what's the word for it? It's a
cheapo. They had a cheap look about them.
Yeah, exactly.
They had this wonderfully cheap, you know, homemade or at least Canadian production style.
That's
about
it.
Them.
Yes, very much.
You know, the way that the early slasher films, when Friday the 13th and Evil Dead first came out, they looked shitty, which was part of the shtick and the charm. You know, movies like Class of Nukem High.
Right.
You know, it was stuff like that. And, you know, to me, of course, Toxic Avenger is one of the true classics of 80s, I don't want to call it schlock cinema, but 80s automatic laugh cinema, because you knew what they were angling for. You know, it was a whole world of their own, you know, Tromaville and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, right. And they used that schlockiness to kind of to say, okay, look, we've got a message here, because all of their films did have some kind of a message to them, but it was going to be delivered in that overly ridiculous and cheap looking fashion, and they did that for a reason. And it wasn't only that they didn't have the money, which they really didn't, but there was more to it than that. And what I love about DW's article is he talks about the fact that, you know, anybody who has that kind of vision, their own vision in this era, is facing an uphill battle, because there's a new censorship on the rise and nobody's really taking too much notice yet, but it would be almost impossible for Troma to do what it did now 30 years on.
Well, you just look at the opening of the conversation when Lloyd Kaufman is talking about, you know, the whole period when video cassettes became the in thing, because this was actually supposed to be part two of the conversation you and I had about DW series on the video culture, the videotape culture.
Yep.
But this turned out to be something, a different pot of gold, if you will. But he talks about the days of, you know, good old Jack Valenti and the Motion Picture Association trying to destroy the whole video market. Because, you know, suddenly independent studios were suddenly making a little bit of money.
Right.
And doing okay and able to go from one production to the next. That's something, you know, just, I don't want to get too far away from what we're talking about, but you notice that every time you watch a movie, there's about six different production companies. At the beginning, the names always seem to reel off before you get to the actual movie.
It's the money go-round, sure.
Yeah, I mean, back then it was, you know, a Troma film, and that's it.
Yep.
You know, and it was Toxic Avenger 1, 2, 3, 6, whatever it was, you know. What you have then is not dissimilar to what you have now. There's always going to be a powers above you that want to destroy you when they see that you're turning a little bit of profit, because they want a cut of it.
Right.
It's like a mafia kind of thing. I mean, who are we kidding?
And as Lloyd Kaufman points out in this interview, the new target for that is not so much the straight-to-video market, but it's the straight-to-Netflix market. It's the streamers that are becoming the place where interesting things happen. I mean, I spent most of this weekend watching the new Mystery Science Theater 3000 on Netflix, because that's where they have to put things like that. And so while there is a burgeoning creativity, there's also a burgeoning shaking at the knees among the big studios right now going, what are we going to do about this?
Well, that's part one of the problem that's currently happening. You have problems with the whole net thing to begin with.
Yep.
Now. You know, this new deregulation where, of course, you know, everybody's shit can be sold by the internet providers. Now, you know, I'm in two minds about it because, of course, that's been happening all along. I don't think we're fooling anybody by saying it hasn't been. The only thing is that this has opened up the doors for them to do it across the board unapologetically.
Right.
But now that also means what content they're going to start flushing into whatever it is you may be looking at, watching, renting, subscribing to. You know, and then of course you've got an asshole who they've just moved into the FCC. You know,
go figure. This administration? Wow.
Hmm. Yeah, I know. It's just the people who are the most inappropriate and inept for the jobs got the jobs.
Right.
You know, talk about really flipping the bird to the general public. But you know, this whole thing with net neutrality, it's. I think this is going to be a bigger fight than anybody even begins to anticipate. You know, the fact is. DW went into some really great, you know, topics of conversation with Lloyd Kaufman, talking about Troma's style of filmmaking and the characters who, you know, on first glimpse you either laughed at or were repulsed by, but now they've become, like so many, beloved.
Right.
I mean, everybody loves the Toxic Avenger, you know?
Yeah, and if you haven't seen...
after 30-plus years.
Right, and if you haven't seen Sergeant Kabuki Man NYPD, well, you know, the picture on the page should be plenty to get you interested in that. But that's... You're right. I mean, there now is... There's a nostalgia about them. Who thought that would happen?
Well... Nostalgia comes for every generation.
Yep.
Even the stuff that you and I, you know, either got a kick out of when we were in our late teens, early 20s, and forgot about over the years, has now become big again.
Yep.
You know, or is being revived and revered. And we can at least look at it with a smile and go, yep. And instead of taking that whole precious approach of, well, we were there first. Okay, so we could just look at it and go, yep, glad to see that somebody's, you know, on the ball.
Right. And the great thing about this particular interview is that you get to see through Lloyd Kaufman's eyes. The one thing that we always wondered about when we were watching movies like this or, you know, listening to music that somebody like Kim Fowley had a hand in, and you think, what did they really think of this? You know, when they were making Bee Bumble and the Stingers, what was really going through their heads about the music that they were creating? And the same thing is true of making the Troma films. So now you get to hear Lloyd Kaufman talk about what was really going through their minds when they were putting all of this stuff out there. I think it's a great tearing off of that sort of, it's an opening of the door into that world.
That's a very good and fair point. But I mean, you know, you look at the way that Lloyd Kaufman kind of lays it all out. He's talking about the way the movies were made then and now, and the underlying topics at hand.
Yeah.
The more subversive ideas that were really motivating the movies.
Right.
Like you said at the very beginning, there was a message underneath all of this. But now, where are they? You know, where are the messages? Well, they're still coming. You haven't seen them yet, but they're coming. And I'm sure that they're going to be hard, heavy, fast, and furious. No puns intended. You know, this is a lot of people... And I hope a lot of creative people have a lot to say and will say it. They will not be shushed.
Yeah, no doubt. And again, a lot of those messages that they were putting in those movies 30 years ago are more than relevant now. And he also says, you know, tell your local theater, if you can find a local theater, you know, tell them you want to see these things back in the big screen and you'll find out. Because, you know, that was another thing, not to go too far off on a tangent. I loved the Midnight movies. And it was so much more than just watching Rocky Horror Picture Show. We did that a lot, but there were so many more of these things. And when I started to see things like Birdemic and The Room start to become popular, I thought, maybe we're getting back to that. And maybe they'll start putting them in on double features with things like Nukem High or movies like that. And it hasn't really been happening, but I would love to see that go on again.
You just brought back a point of nostalgia, though, for me. My first midnight movie was Quadrophenia.
Oh, that's great. Yeah.
Here's just a very fucked up little sidebar. It was playing at the 8th Street Playhouse on 8th Street off of 6th Avenue in the city. And we went, and we were all, you know, these mods. And we were getting hassled by the dimwits who were going to see the Rocky Horror Picture Show in the theater next to you because it was a split cinema.
Right.
What the fuck is that?
Yeah.
You know, we're taking shit for being mods. From fucking not sweet transvestites? Come on. That was as uncool as you could get. But the thing is about the midnight movies, just to give you an illustration, that was my first one. Then a couple weeks later, we went back again to see Dance Craze, which was the British ska movie.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, these were the kinds of things that you would see as midnight movies. You know, for us, it was about going to see music movies. And then to talk about double features, in the town that I grew up in on Staten Island, Eltingville, we had a twin cinema. And one of them, and it was a second-run theater. It was after, so that was what made it really great, because it gave you the chance to see the stuff that you missed the first time around for less the cost. And they would show in one of the cinemas on Saturdays double features. And the most unforgettable double feature I ever went to was, get this one, Rock and Roll High School and The Kids Are All Right.
There you go. Now we're talking. And see, with me, a lot of them were horror movies as well, but they were never really, I mean, it wasn't the serious heavy-duty horror movies. It was always the goofy ones. And it's funny, because this is like the third or fourth time this movie has come up in conversation with me this week. But there was a movie called The Wraith with Charlie Sheen. And, boy, he couldn't have been more than about 19 or 20 when he made this movie. It was terrible. It was a killer car movie. And there were these two characters, Skank and Gutter Boy, who did things like, you know, they drank motor oil and shit like that. I mean, it was brilliantly funny and so weird and so subversive. And I think the first time I saw that movie was on a midnight movie double feature. So we were there until like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And it was that and Repo Man.
Oh, okay.
On a double bill. And it was great. I mean, that was so well worth the 3 or 3.5 hours that it took to just sit there and watch those two movies happen.
Repo Man may be one of the last midnight movies I ever saw.
There you go.
They started, you know, well, and it's funny because it was on just yesterday morning. I was watching it. And, you know, I kind of
really?
Got a little, yeah, on, I think it was on Showtime. I got a little sliver of nostalgia going through me. You know, it's funny when you watch those old movies from your punk rock days,
uh-huh.
and you remember the when, the where, the how, but yet that's about the apex of the emotion that goes with it. There's that little bit of separation from it because you've stepped so far back from it. It's interesting, an interesting thing. But yeah, Repo Man, I think, was one of the last movies I saw at the 8th Street Playhouse before it closed.
Well, just remember, Pablo Picasso was never called an asshole. Rob Ross, John Grayson with you, doing a little talking. And we're going to stick with movies because there's another movie column up on Popdos this week that you're definitely going to want to check out, because here we are at the beginning of another baseball season. And I know this one's killing you right about now, Rob, being the Mets fan that you are. But Pete Chanka takes us through his top 10 baseball movies. And no matter what's going on with your team in any given year, you can always make yourself feel better by checking one of these things out. Where does he go with the column?
You know, as we're talking about this, and then the words baseball is coming out of your mouth, and Mets are coming out of your mouth, and me being a fan is coming out of your mouth, I'm almost tempted to take a glimpse on the ESPN page to see if the Mets have actually gotten a fucking hit in this game. You know, they took out the starting pitcher from the Marlins, but did the Mets have a goddamn hit yet?
No.
That's the question. Fuck. Anyhow, and we don't need to be censored because we're not on major radio
That's
anymore.
Right.
We're just, you know, we are who we are and where we are. And if you don't like it, well, you can't tune us out. You have to listen because we know better.
Yeah.
Anyway, Pete's article is just fantastic, simply because, A, I love baseball movies, B, I love tearing baseball movies apart, and C, he's got a whole slew of them up here that I absolutely love. And the thing is, with the season now being on again,
yeah,
you know, it's time to sit back and you know, look at it, and you know, he's done it by way of Redbox. You know Redbox, they're in the supermarket.
Sure.
They're your instant rental thing, but they actually have a poll about movies, and this one is called America's Favorite Baseball Movies. So just to give you the ones that I would definitely agree with, because there are more of those than ones I would disagree with, Moneyball is on there. Moneyball is a fantastic movie.
Definitely.
It's a great story. I am a big, actually, fan and believer in the whole sabermetric system, quite frankly. I think that Billy Beane, along with Peter DePodesta, were visionaries in taking the Bill James theory of on-base percentage versus spending big money for players that may or may not produce. I can tell you firsthand, for every big-name player that the Mets have signed to a big contract, it never worked out. Bobby Bonilla, Carlos Beltran, I don't give a shit what anybody says.
Right.
You didn't get to the point that you wanted to be at. You didn't win a World Series with any of these guys. So when a team goes for the lower cost, younger players and actually feeds their farm system, that's how you win. That's how you get to where you want. And I think that Moneyball, apart from the fact that it was some of Brad Pitt's finest acting, I think it tells a really poignant story and one that should be paid attention to, because really it's brought up very quickly in the whole essence of the film by saying baseball is antiquated. The whole system is antiquated. The concept of buying your success is antiquated.
Right.
And that's a fact.
Yeah, and you know, you can apply that across sports too, because I think if you're looking at building a hockey team, if you don't have a strong junior system, you're shot. I mean, it's never going to happen. So, yeah, it is. It's a fun movie, and it's interesting that it's probably the least baseball-y of all the baseball movies, and yet it's one that really resonated with me as well. And another
because
one
it's behind the scenes. That's what most people seem to forget about. You know, they want to
so
see
much.
Kind of on-field action, but
right.
That's not it.
Right.
This is what makes it happen. This is what makes it go. This is how you have a baseball season.
Exactly. And you look elsewhere on the list, and I'm glad that that Bull Durham made it, because, and I'm not terribly surprised either. I mean, that's a beloved movie, but it's one that I think tends to, even with baseball fans, take a sort of a second tier. And I don't think it should, because of all of the baseball movies, and I'm not the world's biggest baseball fan anyway, but that one to me was the most fun to watch. It was a good time, and it never took itself too seriously.
Well, the only thing I'll say is this, so that way you and I don't cross swords. Susan Sarandon.
Yeah, right.
So
yeah, right.
Quickly X'd right off my list.
Uh-huh.
So, you know. So let's spin it to one you and I both love from our kidhood, the
sure.
Bad News Bears.
Oh,
which
yeah.
We made our parents take us because we knew we were going to get to hear dirty words.
Yep.
And we knew it was going to be fun. And it was a classic. And anybody who bitches and moans about it, you know, with the drinking and smoking and swearing and racial slurs, too fucking bad.
Yeah.
It was 1976.
Right.
Who are we bullshitting here?
Well, right. And anybody who bitches about those things was obviously never in Little League Baseball, because if that wasn't
right.
Your coach, there was something wrong.
Your teammates?
Right.
You?
Right.
You're a liar.
Yep.
You're an absolute liar. And you were probably, you know, the goody-goody kid who went to the Wednesday catechism classes instead of the baseball practice.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Yep. Yeah,
you
it was.
You probably grew up to be a fucking right-wing think for the moral majority or some shit like that.
And the great thing about it is that it was one of the few times that we got to actually see ourselves reflected on film, because I was right about that age when that movie came out. And yeah, I mean, that was everybody. That's how my friends talked to each other.
So did mine.
Right.
That's how we were. We were all in Little League, and that's how we were on the field. We were we were small versions of major league players.
Right. But nobody wanted to admit that.
We weren't standing there cussing at each other when somebody would fuck up royally.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and then especially later on. But that's the thing, is that, you know, everybody wanted to pretend that we weren't like that. Everybody wanted to pretend that we were, you know, the one and only All-American original family band. And it's like, no, we were a bunch of little punks who would all give each other shit.
Absolutely. Kill or be killed. All we did was we took the playground mentality. We were a little older. Now we're on the baseball field.
Yep.
This is men's sport. Now we're men, you know? This is competitive. It's baseball. Baseball is religion.
Right.
You know, baseball was everything to us when we were kids.
So
there was a fire and brimstone mentality when we went out on that field. Kill or be killed.
Yeah, and that's what it's all about. It's a great primer if you're looking for something, again, to get yourself geared up into baseball season, especially if your team's not doing all that well and you want to just get into
it. Shut up.
If you want
to,
you want to get into a little of the fictional aspect of it. So yeah, you read the article. Pete Chanka does a great job with it. And
well, we do have one more I want to bring up.
Oh, definitely.
To me, this movie is, and again, this to me is the second greatest of all sports movies ever made. Number one sports movie of all time, unquestionably, Slapshot.
Thank you.
Naturally.
I was going to have to reach through the phone if you didn't say that.
that's the one. Number two, greatest sports movie of all time, Major League.
Yes.
Major League is the Slapshot of baseball.
Right, right.
When it just starts off with, look at this fucking guy. You know you're in for a great movie.
Yeah.
And I do it myself. Fuck you, Joe Boo.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah, and you know, much like Slapshot, I mean, it's got that same irreverent take on it, but you know, there's a reality at the basis of it all. Yeah, it's a movie, and yeah, it's even a little goofier than Slapshot, I think, especially when you get into Major League 2, which is an entirely different affair. But yeah, it still has, you feel closer to that as being real sports than you do in a lot of the other ones.
Well, there's something about Major League that I really liked and appreciated, and that is a lot of it, to me, was very reminiscent of Reading Ball 4, which did get made into a movie, even though there was a very brief attempt at doing it as a series. But when you read Ball 4, which is just laugh-out-loud hysterical, a lot of the lines translate into this movie. Like, there's that one scene when one of the batters comes up and says to the catcher, hey, how's your wife and my kids? You know, that's the kind of stuff you found in Ball 4.
Right. So, yeah, definitely want to, if you haven't yet, go do that. But just, yeah, read the piece, because it's got some great things to say about all of these baseball movies. And even something as maudlin as The Natural gets a pretty fair treatment, I think. So do that. It's on the page for you elsewhere online at popdose.com. And we're doing a little Radio City. John Grayson here with you, Rob Ross alongside. Before we get to In Our Heads for this week, we take a look around at what's been going on in the news. And I'll tell you something, a little bit of a tip. If you have not yet, if you have HBO and you don't watch Vice News every night, you are cheating yourself. If you've been sitting here like the rest of us have, going, stop fucking talking about every tweet, every stupid thing that comes out of Washington, D.C., and give me some actual news, Vice News does that. And it, I mean, it's world news. It's local, you know, stuff that happens in some municipality that resonates across the country. They do a fantastic job. Rob, I don't know if you're into Vice News, but it's everything that they promised us when they first started. What was Al Gore's network? Current. When Current first started, they made a promise and never quite pulled through on it. Vice does. That's what they're doing, and it works.
Current was promised to be something, but the minute that it hit the air, you knew it was never going to be what they said it was going to be, because it was too much of the concentrated content that was so badly filtered to me for pop culture and nothing else. There was no hard, factual news behind it.
Right. Yeah.
And it had to die a death. Ironically, it turned into Al Jazeera America, which also died a death, and justifiably so.
Right. Yeah, but Wednesday on Vice, they had a guy who was in embed with the guys that were trying to take back Mosul. And, I mean, they're going block by block with this guy as sniper fire is going overhead, and he's showing, you know, where the bullet holes are going into the but it's done in a realistic way. And he's there not with our guys and not in some kind of, you know, Defense Department sponsored event. He's there with the Iraqi army going, all right, what are you guys dealing with out here? It's great.
There are things that have been on Vice that I've liked and appreciated, because they do the investigative angle.
Yep.
And that's one thing that obviously news organizations across the board have completely nixed,
right,
or lost sight of, or forgot how to do, or just are too goddamn lazy to do. No, seriously, because every time you turn around now, it's not happening.
Well, yeah, but, and I'll tell you, I mean, a lot of that has to do with the same thing. The same reason why the record industry is such a pile of shit right now is because they fired everybody talented, because those people cost money.
Well, you know what? If you want to get results, you have to hire people to do the job.
Yep.
Otherwise, you're not going to have news.
Right.
And people are going to turn you off. And what happens when people turn you off? You have no revenue.
Yeah, exactly. So, unfortunately, that still hasn't filtered through to some of the big networks. In fact, to all of the big networks. But these guys are doing it right. So, it is curious, by the way, that Viceland doesn't show their news segment. That happens on HBO. But who knows? Maybe someday they'll make that switch. I think they probably should. Same time, though, we saw why this is necessary again this week. Because the news industry, oh my God. I mean, if I had a nickel for every dramatic, drastic mistake that they made in covering world events, I would have enough money to pay the mortgage this month.
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about, not just last week, but I think for the last three shows. You know, what I've said about things like MSNBC suddenly becoming basically Fox.
Right, right.
And with a more lefty slant. But still, they're going for the sensationalist angle that Fox does.
Not to mention,
nothing redeeming.
Right. And not to mention the fact that, I mean, when we're firing, what was it, 59 cruise missiles into Syria, how about not sit here and have an orgasm about, oh, don't they look beautiful on TV? Oh, look at this. It's breathtaking. It's fucking instruments of death. I mean, you know, there's a story here that goes beyond, boy, don't this look cool? It's like fireworks.
Here's the thing. You just nailed it right on the head. You know, they're busy coming in their pants over this, the different ways that they can, you know, fine-tune these stories. You know, Rachel Maddow can use her bully pulpit to you know, suddenly go right back on the attack of Trump. Now, I'm not defending Trump because I never would. The guy's an asshole.
Right.
You know, he may be the president, but this president's an asshole and an ineffectual president at that. And his entire cabinet are all ineffectual.
Right.
But the fact is that they're aiding and abetting this whole, I don't even know what you want to call it, series or whirlwind of missteps by anyone and everyone.
Bingo.
The news media are completely in bed with the government on
right,
this.
Right.
Because they're letting this shit happen in a way that is just beyond description. I'm sure, God help us, Walter Cronkite's rolling over in his grave. You know, I'm sure you saw the little piece that Dan Rather wrote about the whole way that, you know, Trump's gone about doing things, but he did it in a way that you get it and you understand it immediately, and that's why your teeth are set on edge.
Right.
You know, this whole glorification of the mother of all bombs. But in the meantime, now all of a sudden, you've got the news media saying, well, this was a good thing to do.
Yeah, what?
All right, let's look at from a factual standpoint. Is it really? And I say that because you're making a claim without substantiated proof that you killed 90 ISIS members
and no civilians.
Right. And there's no collateral damage, and you did it in this network of tunnels in Afghanistan. Well, what about the 300 or 400 ISIS guys that are there in Syria that you probably have dead in your sights, no pun intended.
Right. And and we don't want to make any kind of real commitment there. And I mean, you look at the progression of events and you have these 59 missiles that were shot off. And that wasn't the only thing that shot off that night. Like we were saying, everybody in the press was sitting there going, oh, and so what happens just a couple of days later? Well, we have a president who lives and dies by ratings and thinks that as long as you get praise for what you do on TV, you're doing it right. Well, he shot off 59 missiles and they praised him on TV. So what's the logical next step? What else do we have that blows up real big?
And what's blowing up real big is his press secretary shooting his mouth off.
Yeah, right. On Passover.
Let's look at this, shall we? Allow me a liberty for a moment. I will try and keep myself contained and pretend to be the voice of reason and
sure.
rationale here.
Yeah.
You know, okay, so you've got Easter Bunny Spicer coming out there and saying that Hitler never used gas on his own people.
Yeah.
Are you sure about that?
Right.
You never heard of Zyklon B? First of all, did you ever go to school?
Yeah. Well,
any school? Public school? Junior high? High school?
I think it's a little darker than that even, because I think, not that there's any justification for this at all, but I think if you went back and asked anybody that was involved in the use of the gas, they would have said, those aren't our people, those are Jews.
Right.
So what
now
is...
That's you absolutely bring up a completely correct point, which I have had this conversation this week. Now...
So we have the guy who's the press secretary giving deference to that opinion. It's
right.
Like, what?
That's one. Because as we all know, you know, even though German Jews were incredibly obstinate, saying that they were German first, Jewish second, well,
yeah.
Unfortunately, look at where a lot of them wound up.
Right.
You know, that was the one thing that always bothered me about the whole mentality of what you know, drove the Holocaust to such great numbers, is the fact that when they could have gotten out and should have gotten out before, you know, countries, not shockingly, started closing their borders.
Yeah.
They didn't, because this is my country. I'm German. No. They're trying to exterminate.
Yeah. And
do you understand that?
Well, and by the way, while we're talking about countries closing their borders, let's not forget we were one of them.
Right. Well, let's not forget Henry Ford had a very big buzz in Roosevelt's ear.
Right.
You know, because Henry Ford was a great supporter of der Führer. you know?
Right.
Now, I'm going to have to take a personal liberty, even though I'm usually loath to do this. As a member of the Chosen People, I take great umbrage with Spicer's commentary by the sheer blatant ignorance, and it goes right back to what you and I were talking about with people tossing the word Nazi around like it's confetti.
Right.
The thing is, Spicer's old enough to understand and know. There's the difference and there's the crime involved in it. It's one thing if you've got these millennial dipshits who want to say Nazi this and Nazi that.
Right.
Well, they're fucking retards who don't know any better.
Right.
We're of that age of, you know, certainly if you have family members who survived the Holocaust, you're going to fucking know.
Yeah, yeah. You heard these stories, you know, firsthand.
You're getting right. So that's egregious point number two on Spicer. And then Holocaust centers, number three.
Yeah.
Okay, do I really need to go beyond that? Holocaust centers? No, no, I can think of things like the after... It's not like the after-school center. Okay, they're Jews, school is done. Send them to the Holocaust center. Yeah. Let them stay there for a couple hours, send them back out to the factories tomorrow, okay?
Yeah.
When it's time for them to go for a shower, gas them, you know? What the fuck?
Yeah, I don't. I wish I could come up with something that made any kind of sense, but there just isn't any to make. And the fact is that even by the time he got to that point where he used that hateful line about Holocaust centers, it was clear that he realized his fuck up. He knew by that point, oh, what did I do? And he still... What's the fallback position? He still tried to worm his way out of it. Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, that's not what I meant. I get what you're saying about, you know, and he just couldn't bring himself to go, oh, wow, yeah, I fucked up. I'm sorry.
Right,
you know,
right.
It took hours.
And his apology attempt made it even worse because the apology attempt...
Right.
It's almost like, you know what? The body's already dead. Why are you shooting it still?
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it was so bad. And, you know, it's going to get to the point where they're not going to have anybody left because they're still trying to get rid of Steve Bannon. Which fine. And they're going to have
Leanne
to figure out.
Conway is somewhere on ice, finally. Yeah. I think maybe they put her back in the crypt. But now fucking Spicer, you know.
Yeah.
And yeah, you said it right at the very beginning of this little cycle. He did it during Pesach.
Yeah.
How fucking dumb are you?
Yeah.
Seriously, dude. You know, it's bad enough that fucking Trump wasn't even at a Seder with his so-called Orthodox, you know, son-in-law and so-called Orthodox converted daughter.
Yeah, right.
Which, there was no Passover Seder in the White House. You know what? Fuck all y'all. But... you're doing this on Pesach, you stupid piece of shit.
Exactly.
If I ever see the guy, I'm personally going to punch him right in the mouth just on principle.
Give him another one from me. And we're going to bring things back up. We've got another note to go into, and it's time for... And, but, you know, they make it so easy. They make themselves such easy targets, and, you know... This too shall pass. This will eventually come to an end. It's all a matter of how and when. So when that happens, we'll be here to talk over all of the details here on Radio City. But it's time to turn our attention to what's going on in our heads this week. And in my In Our Heads segment is going to start with a little discussion about legacy, because the song that hit me, that again was picked out by my phone, and then I played it endlessly over and over and over again after that, is Derek Trucks's take, along with the Derek Trucks Band, on the Bob Dylan classic, Down in the Flood.
Well, it's sugar for sugar, salt for salt. If you go down in the flood, it's gonna be your own fault. Oh, mama, ain't you gonna miss your best friend now? Yourself another best friend somehow.
And it is wonderful. I mean, there is not a note out of place. The vocal delivery is perfect. Derek Trucks is, I mean, if it weren't for the Allman Brothers before him, and by the way, if you don't know, his legacy delves through the Allman Brothers Band because his uncle was their drummer, Butch Trucks, who, by the way, just died a couple of weeks ago, and it was an amazing talent. But that's the world that Derek Trucks grew up in, and I remember seeing this guy when he was 13 or 14 years old playing at Skipper's Smokehouse in Tampa going, this kid is incredible. And he's one of the truly nice guys in rock and roll. His wife, Susan Tedeschi, is a shredder. She's incredibly talented, and they're just great people. But it's the music that is what this is all about. And what struck me on all of these listens through over and over again is the fact that that list of true rock and roll legacies of somebody who is the son of or the daughter of is a fairly short list. I mean, much shorter. If you look at what goes on in Hollywood and how many people that we watch who have famous parents, famous grandparents now, that's a fairly storied path. But you look at it in rock and roll and there's just not that many of them. Who can you name outside of somebody like Derek Trucks? You look at even John Bonham's kid, Jason Bonham. He's done some things and he's done some good things, but he's never done anything great. It's few and far between. I mean, is there anybody, Rob, who sticks out in your head as being that legacy who really ended up working out well?
Not really, no. unfortunately, I can think of those who had their starts and stops. I'll go you a good one, because you and I talked about them several months ago upon the passing of Leon Russell. Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Yeah.
Gary Lewis, who's the son of Jerry Lewis. Now, Jerry Lewis isn't a rock and roll musician, but Gary Lewis went into rock and roll.
Yep.
And put out some great, obviously memorable singles, because they're still played to this day on oldie stations, and they're certainly part of, you know, my musical fabric. But, you know, it didn't sustain past a certain period of time. Now, the biggest name that I can think of that did not fulfill the promise that was very unfairly levied on his shoulders and put around him like a yoke is Julian Lennon.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, I had a conversation with him this week on the radio.
You know, here's a guy who I always felt got the very short end of the stick and wasn't allowed to be who he was for the sake of who he was, because the powers that be wanted him to be his father, and his career started less than 5 years after his father's death.
Right.
You know, when the album Velotte came out, there was a lot of hoopla behind it and a lot of anticipation behind it.
And it was a solid record.
A very good album. And I think a lot of people just, you know, here's a big problem with rock and roll and certainly the generations before us. They have their icons and they won't let them go, and if there's a son or daughter involved, they want to see that lineage continue almost the exact same way.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's very unfair. You know, this is a person unto himself.
Right.
Allow him to be him. Now, having said that, Velotte was a really, really good album. I actually thought the second album, The Secret Value of Daydream, was much better and got no response whatsoever. It was a failure. And subsequently, I don't think he sold another record after that. I know he put out an album called Here Comes Mr. Jordan, and then he kind of faded away for a bit.
Yeah.
Certainly he was dropped by Atlantic Records. Now, let's talk about the other spawns of the Beatles. You know, Zach Starkey, to me, is probably the most successful of all of them, because he played drums for Oasis, and now he's been playing drums for The Who for the last 6 or 7 years. Maybe even longer. No, you know what? It's longer than that, because he was playing drums for them after the 9/11 attack.
Right.
So he's been doing it, for 16 years. You know, and he's done it with an incredible sense of steadiness and the closest drumming that they've had to Keith Moon since Keith Moon's passing.
Yeah, and that says a lot. So he's there, and Stella McCartney didn't even go into music. She's a fashion designer.
Right, and Mary McCartney is a fairly successful photographer. James McCartney is now doing his own thing, and he's out on tour. But unfortunately, I've noticed, and this is one of the few, it's one of the good negatives about something like social media and Facebook. I've seen a lot of people say these really, they don't mean it to be crass, because they're such goggle-eyed fans of Paul's. But you know, it's like, oh, you know, are you doing such and such like your dad or with your dad? Don't ask him questions like that. That's really unfair. And it's really immature and really inappropriate.
Yeah, that's frankly. True. Yeah, and of course,
people don't know any better. They just don't know.
Exactly. And of course, there's the other Lennon son as well, because Sean has made some pretty interesting music. And the good thing about him is that he vocally doesn't sound as much like John. So it was never really expected of him the way that it was expected of Julian, that he would follow in dad's footsteps and make the same kind of music, be that sort of next generation John Lennon.
Right, and the other thing is, Sean Lennon, I don't think, gives a shit. And I think that's a really good thing.
Yes,
I think he's pretty unaffected by it. He's like, look, I do my own thing, and that's that.
Yep.
I have done with it, you know? And he's done several different things. You know, he put out his own records, and then he put out a record with a band called the Ghost of a Saber-Toothed Tiger, you know, so he does different things, and I don't think he's too affected by it. And certainly Danny Harrison hasn't really done anything, but Danny Harrison's an interesting guy because he's got a degree in science. He can do anything.
Right.
I mean, he is no slouch.
Like Brian May.
You know, if he wants to go into the sciences and not be bothered with music, God bless him, let him do it, you know? If he wants to go in music, he can. But, you know,
yeah.
He's got his own thing going on. And yeah, there was that very, very off-putting idea that was mooted a couple of years ago about the Beatles 2.0 with, what was it, Julian, Jimmy, Zach, and Danny Harrison all doing something. You know, the other kids, you know, don't forget, McCartney, well, we talked about McCartney's kids, you know. Ringo's other son, I think Jason is the other, and his daughter Lee, you know, they do their own things. Nobody has to be involved in music. There isn't a call to arms that everyone's children have to be musicians.
Right.
And yeah. I think that's a fallacy, really. I mean, look at Hank Williams Jr., who claims to be the son of Hank Williams anyway. I mean, he's about as far from his daddy's legacy as you can get.
Yeah, and then there's Hank III, so, you know, continuing in that vein. But there is one other that I will give to you who I think is a guy who, again, is a tremendously nice guy, and I wouldn't say that he's made it into the upper echelons or even the echelons of the music business part of things, but Mike Nesmith's son, Christian, who toured with the Monkees on the last tour when Mike was going around with him as well, he is such a fantastic human being, and his I don't know if they're married, I think it's his girlfriend, Cersei Link, that he writes songs for now, and she performs them. She's got a hell of a voice, and so it's worth looking them up.
100% agreed. They're two absolutely lovely people, incredibly talented people. His brother Jonathan is also really, really talented.
Yeah.
Has that wonderful band Mother of Winter. I mean, you know, these are just, but they're doing it because they love doing it. You know,
right.
I'm sure that they could do other things because Mike has done other things than music. You know, don't forget, for the longest time, he was involved in just film and exploring the new media of film and video and, you know, he's a right. They can do anything they want because they're, you know, they're their own people. They're not trading off the legacy. And I think that's the key thing. And there's no, you know, unlike, for argument's sake, somebody like Jacob Dylan, who had to be scrutinized by everybody, you know, for you know, being in a band.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, that poor kid.
But listen, the Wallflowers did, you know, it's interesting because the Wallflowers started kind of as a punk band.
Right.
But then became this more, you know, Americana-ish, you know, down-home, funky, southern soul-style, kind of Tom Petty-like band. Well, you know, as you get better as musicians, you know, obviously you're going to change direction. But getting away from what I was going to say, you know, he's a fine musician in his own right. And the problem with the concept of legacy has always been and will continue to be your parents and the inevitable and very automatic unfair comparison.
Yes.
So that's so many, and we're not talking about when it comes to actors, because they're given their own little path to either pass or fail. Musicians, the expectations are already laid out very unfairly.
Right.
Very unfairly.
Yeah.
And I don't appreciate that. You know, that's why, you know, listen, if James McCartney put out an album that blew us away, it would be great because he put out an album that blew us away, not because he's Paul McCartney's son. I couldn't give a shit.
Yeah, right. And, you know? And honestly, I mean, the job of acting doesn't change as much. It doesn't change as much as trends in the music industry change, as technology in the music industry changes. If you're an actor, you go act. You know, it's not to say it's easy, but it's just it doesn't go through the same kind of shifts that lead to those unfair comparisons in the music business.
Now we're, you know, you and I are part of that generation, and then some. Did we give a shit that Carrie Fisher was the daughter of Debbie Reynolds and Eddie Fisher? No, we couldn't have given a fuck. We all fell in love with her because she was really gorgeous, and she was, you know, she was a kick-ass character.
Yeah,
that's why.
Right.
You know, that's how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
That's your legacy. You know, Lisa Marie Presley has a great voice, very reminiscent of Sheryl Crow. She put out a terrific album. Did anybody really give her a fair shot?
No.
Of her own merits? No.
No,
that's not fair.
So that brings us actually back around to the one other column that we wanted to mention from another pen on Popdos this week. And we mentioned this way at the beginning of our conversation. We'll kind of wrap it up and end on this one because Ted Azregadu put together a piece on classic rock. And he and I share, I think, a disdain for where, especially where classic rock radio has gone. But he takes it more into the direction of, okay, what's going to happen next? Because if you listen to the radio stations now that describe themselves as classic rock, they've convinced themselves that The Who, The Rolling Stones, The Beatles, and just about every other band, Led Zeppelin, all the bands that we grew up listening to, all only made 3 or 4 songs during their entire career.
Well, that's the whole thing with this whole pre-programming shit with all regular radio now.
And they wonder why they're killing it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you know, if you happen to listen to a terrestrial station, which I think the last time I actually listened with an attentive ear to a terrestrial station happened to have been about 3 years ago when I was in a physical therapy session. And I don't even know the name of the station in New York anymore, to be honest with you, who it is or what, you know, what the frequency is. But it was a 2 for Tuesday also. So they were obviously operating on the old premise of WNEW 102.7. But
right.
I want to say the first two songs were, of course, Lion Eyes and Take It Easy.
Yeah.
Okay. Followed by Black Dog and then... well, in this case, it was Fool in the Rain because I hadn't heard that in ages.
Right.
And that's like a 6-hour song anyhow.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they did go for a kind of a left field, Pictures of Lily and then Pinball Wizard.
Yeah. But that's, you know, both of them are on the best of. And, you know, with The Who, I remember not too long ago listening to a Block Party Weekend, again, taking off on that same routine, on a station out of Oklahoma City, and they said, we've got a block of The Who coming up. And I turned to my wife and I said, here's the 3 songs they're going to play. Not only did I hit them all in order.
Let me guess. Baba O'Reilly, Won't Get Fooled Again, Who Are You?
Bingo.
Fuck.
Right. Yeah, exactly. There's no imagination to it at all. And yet, you know, streaming does present an interesting conundrum for folks who are listening to that kind of music, because it's either you go and seek out exactly the stuff you want, and there's a certain, I don't know, I like being surprised. But that's the thing. I like being surprised, and there's nowhere that I can count on that now.
Well, the only way you can be surprised, if you will, is if you have, at this stage of the game, satellite radio.
Right.
And you have a station on like Little Steven's Underground Garage, which is probably the one that I keep it on the most.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, I was a subscriber to XM originally, mm-hmm. back in 2005. So I've been in this for quite a while now, and I was not keen on the merger between XM and Sirius because I felt XM had the better edge and the better criteria of what they were working with. But nonetheless, Little Steven's Underground Garage is a mixture and a surprise.
Right. Yeah,
there
because
are no playlists.
Because it's
no
him.
Fancy anything.
Yeah, because
there's no predictability.
Exactly. Because it's him, and he's the one that's coming up with a playlist and hitting you with things that are very much the same we are in our heads here on the broadcast every week. So, yeah, it's there's a few of those outlets out there, but not nearly enough. And that, again, I think that's the internet failing to come through on its promise the same way that radio is now failing in theirs. So we'll see. We'll see if somebody picks it up. But again, you can check out the column online at popdos.com from Ted Azregadu. And it's under the beautiful title, Birth, School, Classic Rock, Death. So go do that. And Rob Ross, in the meantime, we'll look forward to reading your bylines over the course of this week. Anything you want to promote coming up?
You betcha. Thursday is the review coming up for the brand new DVD/Blu-ray/2CD set of Big Stars Third Live and More.
Excellent. So we'll be watching out for that.
I want to say one little thing about that as a sort of the epilogue to the whole classic rock thing. Keeping in mind now the punk rock that you and I grew up with, the first wave. That's now classic rock.
Yeah, yeah, it is. And or at least that's how they classify it, but you're right. I mean, I'm starting to hear that stuff pop up more and more often, which I'm fine with, but it just shows you how much they need to sort of expand the catalog. In the meantime, by the way, we mentioned that conversation with Julian Lennon, and want to put my own little plug in here. If you go to KTRS.com, that's the radio station where I make my living during the course of the week, go there and you can hear some of these interviews that we've done just recently with people like Julian Lennon. As a matter of fact, had a conversation with, of all people, Barry Manilow just recently as well, and one of the members of Deep Purple. There's all kinds of stuff up there. So if you get the chance, kick around that for a while. I think you'll have some fun with it.